The date is October 11th, 2007. We are at the Atlantic Coast Bank at 8th and Center Streets in Fernandina Beach, Florida. The following interview is being conducted as part of the Mihi Island Museum of History's Veterans History Project in partnership with the Library of Congress. Today, we are interviewing Chief Cryptologic Technician Harry E. Bowman, United States Navy, retired. Chief Bowman was born on the 17th of May in 1936 in Somerset, Pennsylvania. My name is Don Hill, and I will interview Chief Bowman on behalf of the Amelia Island Museum of History. Assisting me is Gerhard Tam, who will operate the recording equipment and participate in the interview. I will now begin the interview. Harry, you were 18 when you enlisted. Where were you? What were you doing, and what prompted your decision to enter the Navy?
I was actually up on a 80-foot ladder painting the gable ends of a Catholic church. And my father was down at the bottom of the ladder giving me some instructions, and I kept motioning to my ears that I couldn't hear him. So he disappeared and came back with another ladder and ran it up alongside of me. And I came back down off the ladder, went to Johnstown, and attempted to enlist in the United States Navy. Well, the recruiter was out, so I went down the next day at noon and then enlisted. I was itching to get out of Somerset County. The male gender of the Ballin family only ever came out during wars. I guess we came out the first time in the Revolution, and then in the Civil War, and World War I, and World War II, and Korea, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Having no idea that when I came in the Navy that I would stay in for the better part of my life. From there, I went to boot camp in Bainbridge, Maryland, 1st Regiment, Company 367. This was all but interesting, learning the protocol, learning from the Blue Jackets manual, and preparing myself to go out into the world of the Navy. I was fortunate. My test scores provided me with some good scores. I was able to qualify for almost any school I wanted to go to in the Navy, within reason. From there, in boot camp, I went to San Diego, California, to radioman school as a part-time basis, and then from there, I continued up the radio aspect and went to Imperial Beach, California, for basic school of communications technician. This would be our branch. Did quite well up until probably two-thirds of the way through school, and ended up with a double echo in my ear. I had trouble distinguishing S's from H's, H's from the Russian character Sha, etc. I was called in to the chief instructor, and he said, "What do you want me to do with you?" I said, "I don't want to get out of this security thing." I said, "I would like to, is there another branch and I can go to?" And he said, "We will send you to O Branch School." Back to San Diego for Telemann School, back to Imperial Beach for CTO Advanced School. From there, I went to Naval Security Group Detachment, SINPAC Fleet. It would be at Wally Wall at the time, called Navy 85. Not the happiest sailor in the fleet, being up in Wally Wall in the pineapple field. If anything came up, I generally had my hand up in the air to go and join in. I went temporary duty into the 7th Fleet, fulfilled the mission, came back to Hawaii, was back for about 8 months. An opportunity came up for volunteers to go to Turkey. I volunteered to go to Turkey and ended up at Tuzluk Detachment 28, Karamansel, Turkey. It's about 100 miles from Istanbul, out on the Sea of Marmara. We dealt in the communications aspect. We had all branches there of intercept from voice to electronic emissions. Our primary job in the comm center was handling this intelligence electrically and transmitting it to appropriate authority. While I was there, the comm officer decided they needed help at Tuzluk Detachment 12 in Istanbul. I was sent on a change of duty to Istanbul to Tuzluk Detachment 12, which was at Anadolu Kavak, up on the mouth of the Black Sea, fulfilling the same mission of electronic and voice intercept. Only here we had another little job. We kept our eye on everything that moved in and out of the Bosporus. This was a fairly interesting duty station, again, because we had to live on the economy and travel by ferry to get to work. And we were working 24-hour shifts, an eve day mid, and getting 72 hours off to go in and to Istanbul to our residence where we live. So it was like living in Europe and working in Asia. We did have an occasion to see Churchill come through the Bosporus on Onassis's boat, and we had the embassy boat out and got the victory salute from him, which we clapped and returned, and on they went, and back to Kavak we went. I had a good tour in Istanbul. Learned a lot, advanced in rate there. Then from there, when the tour was up, I got transferred back to the United States to the National Security Agency at Fort George G. Meade, Maryland. I was stationed attached to Op 922Y1 under Captain Edwards. This was a NFOIO office, the Naval Office of Field Intelligence. Here we were involved in a paper aspect. What we did, what we received, we distributed internally, and we're sitting on top of the, so to speak, Crystal Palace of where everything was supposedly happening. On every watch, I was supervisor of one watch, and one of my watch officers was Lieutenant Commander Bobby Inman, who later turned in to be the deputy director of the CIA. From there, I went to the USS USS Oxford during the Cuban crisis, and we were deployed out of Norfolk and stayed on the Cuban crisis until 1964. Castro used to call us a hazard to navigation. This was involved in the same kind of reception of intelligence, voice, electronic emission, whatever was going on. We had the first communications via satellite to National Security Agency. I was on watch the day that we communicated and set up our cryptographic equipment online, and this was a first in communications via satellite.
Could you expand on that, Harry? That's when they put the big dish on the fantail of the vessel,
bounced it
off the
satellite.
Yeah. Well, I thought, didn't they start bouncing off the moon at the beginning?
That. Yeah, they had.
Right.
It was a trial and error period, but before we...
Ahead of its time, though.
Ahead of its time.
Yes.
Before we came home, we were having some pretty good, steady communications. We still had backup systems. One time we lost power. We had a fire in the shaft alley, and we had to... everybody got a little jumpy. Being that the Cubans were sending out small surface crafts and running around the ship, and we didn't know if we were going to float into Havana Harbor or what was going to be our destination. So we sent out a high-priority message, and finally we got a jet aircraft in from Tampa. And we were underway and going in the other direction, and he gave us a wing wave, and he went back to Tampa, and we went off about our business. It was interesting, to say the least, because it was, this was in the 60s, and we have people running around the ship in a repel boarders party. With two 50 caliber machine guns and about two dozen M1s, it was more than, it was almost funny, except it wasn't almost funny. Then I had a little misfortune and ended up in Rodriguez Army Hospital with a broken jaw. It was sort of like stumbling over the hatch, falling on a table that was welded to the deck, and hitting it at the wrong place and being transferred over to Rodriguez Army Hospital to get wired up and get reassembled. From there, I was in contact with the Personnel Bureau, and my enlistment was about to be due, and I said I just as soon re-enlist and go to London, England, and they said, you got a deal. I re-enlisted and went to London, England. This was probably the peak of my career as far as things went. I was always a support person. I was not what you'd call a Class A combatant. In a couple team ads, we supported Marine detachments and did this and that. But here we were supporting the Commander-in-Chief of U.S. Naval Forces Europe, which was very interesting due to the nature of what he did and what he was responsible for. This called for some more transfer of active duties. We went to Scotland. We went up north of England when we had intelligent ships in the area. I was put on special operations chief, which involved the submarine fleet. At this stage of the game, probably I accomplished as much as I had ever accomplished up to that point in my career. I became highly involved in a project which gave encrypted intelligence on a low frequency out to the submarine fleet, and it was all in a very highly sensitive format known as SOSUS Bridge. This system was bought from the British to which anything that was handled in Sosa's Bridge was marked Navy eyes only. However, we in the communication center, we had stunts on our transmitter decenters because we had to circuits to the British intelligence service. It wasn't an uncommon thing for me to go down to retrieve a satchel full of tape and carbon copies, et cetera, of something that slipped through the cracks. The British thought it was funny, and I thought it was indeed humorous because they would have did the same thing I did. They would have had copies before I got there. But that was one of our prime allies, and nobody got court-martialed or nobody got hung by the rope. It was just one of the misfortunes of things. I wrote the op order for the submarines. I went to the NATO conference to get access to the transfer for the cryptographic equipment we had to put online due to the nature of its start time. It actually started at 000 Zulu. And the transmitter came on the air, and the receivers ran it over 500 times its normal operating speeds till it sunk in with the receiver. This way, they could get it from periscope depth. They could get the intelligence via a trailing line, or they can just come up for a suntan. Whatever whatever was going on the boat was in charge of the commander of that boat. This system was highly effective. It was highly effective, very, very useful. We had actual locations, times, and presence of Russian submarines no matter where they were. This system was compromised after I retired. I think I was in Sarasota, Florida, and sitting in front of the television one night when they come up and explained the whole system over the news. It was so startling, and I couldn't believe what I was hearing. Anyway, it happened. A radioman by the name of Walker compromised the system. The Russians immediately brought in their submarines and rehoned their props, so they could not be re-identified when they went back out to sea. I am not aware of any system in effect now or since then that has been that effective and that closely held in the history of the Navy. That was an isolated system, and people in it weren't like leaves on the trees. You had a special clearance to have access to it. Even my operators who handled the tapes had special clearances to be able to be in the same area as being transmitted.
Okay, Harry, after you went to Anthorn and got all these very sophisticated modern communications capabilities developed and you came back to London, what was on your agenda at that point? What happened next?
Well, the Admiral was quite, I won't say disturbed, but he was wondering if I understood who was running Europe. And I said, well, everybody knows that. You are. He said, well, let me, according to Lieutenant Commander Gordon, and it seemed to have been some doubt in your mind when you told him that you personally thought we should get out of NATO and buy our own transmitter and put it on the air. And they finally conceded to getting your R's. And I don't know, maybe you have a talk with your boss, Lieutenant Commander Gordon, and he seemed to be in quite a lot of anguish and misery over your actions.
And at this point, we're speaking of Admiral John S. McCain, four-star admiral,
yes.
Commander-in-Chief, U.S. Naval Forces Europe.
Yes, this was all due to the fact that I hand-carried the message, the first critic I ever handled, as a matter of fact. I broke it back on what we called a KL-47 system. It was a five-letter code group system.
Maybe explain briefly, Harry, and you're the expert to do so, what a critic message is.
It's the most expeditious and highly classified message of critical intelligence to the entire intelligence and military situations. This critic that I handled, I don't know if it would even fit into any of those categories. However, it was initiated to let the admiral know that his son had been shot down over the country of Vietnam, and a full-scale investigation was being carried out. This was an officer's eyes only type of message, admiral's eyes only. I decrypted it and took off for staff quarters and to deliver the message to the admiral, and the chief of staff got rather disturbed because I told him he was the captain and this was the admiral's eyes only message. I don't think the Captain Smith really enjoyed the comment or anything else, but however, I did get in to see the admiral, and I got to know the admiral. Maybe I was a sounding board, or maybe he just wanted to talk, but he knew me, and I knew him, and the familiarity, maybe he said things to me later on that he might not have said because he knew that I had generally had some of the same thoughts in the back of my mind. I was just maybe a little more outspoken than he was.
And you were a chief petty officer at this point.
I was a chief petty officer, yes, sir. I always thought he would go on to become CNO, but there was maybe some bad feelings there, and I should imagine had somewhat to do with the Liberty Escapade carried on by President Johnson. It was probably one of the most disastrous things that ever happened in the history of the United States Navy. And it was also a shameful show of response to a ship in trouble. There was bad feelings on the part of the Navy. There was bad feelings on the part of the personnel. There was bad feelings on the part of the home front, which there was letters going back and forth from service people, not only in staff command in London, but from what I could gather, the whole world wasn't really happy with the situation. Not by a long shot did I think we should drop an atomic bomb on the state of Israel. But I should have impressed him with a show of force enough to say and find him a token gesture. I don't care if they're allied or not. They validated their trust. They ignored our presence in the fact that we were there not as a combatant. What our job was, I'm sure they had knew that too. Whether they were carrying on unethical practices, and it certainly was to attack a ship when some of the crew was out on the sun deck and slaughter them in the water as well as sinking lifeboats, etc. And this was all brought up at various times through this investigation. It was a lot of traffic coming back and forth, and the admiral himself went to Malta to inspect the damage. Admiral was very upset and depressed commander of Sixth Fleet was equally upset and distressed at the lack of support they got from the President of the United States on the issue of we have done nothing, we have committed them to the deep. The thought behind it was he didn't care if we lost the whole ship with everybody on it. He was not going to give one of our allies any difficulty or help. And that's the way it was left. They paid a small tribute of to the country, and issue was swept under the rug, and it's still there, but the bubble in the rug is still very visible, and there's still an element of people left alive yet who are still disgusted over the Liberty incident. This might leave us to be anti-Jewish. I would say it would be a little lesser than that. I would say is even in the Bible, Paul says all Israelis are not Israel. I would give him go so far as to give him that much. But as far as being an ally, I don't consider him an ally. Now, I didn't consider them an ally afterwards. They're out for their own end, and Johnson only committed them to do whatever they wanted to do whenever they wanted to do it. As far as I can see, it's still going on.
Started here. Okay, after the Liberty incident, Harry, what transpired next in your Navy career in London?
There wasn't sometime in between in this interval, we had moved the communications center from Audley Street over to Province Court, which would be like moving it across the back alley. We had a brand new comm center, and the only thing we did, we put it in a enclosure box that controlled electronic emissions. Took quite a bit of time and engineering to set it up, but finally we got it set up, and one of my supervisors on watch got somewhere or another had a big blow up of Admiral McCain, and we did a sign and put the picture on it and hung it up inside the comm center hatch, left us in and out, that the country has Uncle Sam, but here in London we got Uncle John. And I think the Admiral got wood into this, and apparently it seemed to tickle him pretty good, because there were some people within the Naval Security Group detachment thought it was in poor taste, but it seems to be when I left London, the picture was still up. I had a chat with the Admiral and right before I left, sometime before I left, and he said, go tell my chief of staff what you have in mind, and I'm sure he'll be able to handle it for you. And I said, well, I appreciate that, Admiral. And so I stopped by his desk on the way back to our floor, and was sort of reluctant at how I was going to break into this conversation. And I was standing there looking down at my feet, remember even pawing at the floor, I don't know, when he said, what's on your mind, Chief? I said, well, the Admiral thought it might be feasible if I was sent to Navy Instructor School in Norfolk, Virginia, and then for further transfer to Corey Field in Pensacola. He said, I think that has a feasible outlook. And he said, is there anything else? I said, no, sir. And my hand was about on the doorknob when He called my attention to the fact that maybe I was done, but he wasn't. And I turned around to see what the captain had in mind. And he said, "Chief, please do me the kindness of going down to the personnel officer and filling out a special request form like every other sailor in this Navy." And I said, "Yes, sir, I'll take care of it immediately," to which I did. And when my orders came through to go to instructor school in Norfolk, it was almost obvious there wasn't any place else I could go to instruct except in CT school in Pensacola, Florida, to wit is where I ended up in 1968 in basic O'Brien school as an instructor. This was a mind-opening tour. Not only did I feel I was accomplishing something with my field experience, trying to input it into the heads of the students, but I come to find out that a lot of the students were actually college graduates and all in to get in under the Korean bill, and they were quite receptive. And not only that, they had problems like any other student had. You had to motivate them a little bit, and it just wasn't instructing. We didn't have to go to college to learn our subject. I started learning mine in 1955. Here it is, 1968. I'm just imparting the knowledge. There was quite an upgrade in communications from 1955 to 1968, and a lot of sophistication and other things. Well, these students had to be part of all this. They had to be prepared when they went into the field to be able to use all this. It was enjoyable to instruct, and it was a tour of duty where I had to go to certain areas of education where I had not been before. I got a little bit of psych. I got a little bit of leadership. I got a little bit of college. They were, and not only that, when you got through taking a class through the basic school, the advanced school, you had a sense of accomplishment. You felt like you'd done something. Especially if they were all standing there in line that started out when you first saw them in line when you picked them up to go to basic school. These were the new generation of sailors. This was a generation of sailor that I guess you could say from a chief from the old school was trying to adapt to the ways of the new school. Admiral Zumwalt was chief of naval operations, and a lot of his policy needed being done. It was just seemed to me it was a little hard to identify with some of them. However, they upscaled and downscaled, and we all survived, and things went on, and the class of sailor either was up or down, or they still came out of school with an education and they needed to do their job. After this tour of duty, I got orders to Nicosia, Cyprus. This was another live on the beach, don't wear your uniform. We were attached to the American embassy. Shared a compound at Eurylochus, which was physically, I guess you could say, a haven for the CIA. They had the bottom floor, naturally. We had to climb up the steps to get to the top floor. But at least one time the CIA was not on top of us. We were on top of them. It was some exhilaration to know that they were actually below somebody. We functioned well, except when we got into the physic element of a softball game, which could get rather exciting. I mean, you know, they did their best to run us down in the baseline, and we attempted to run over them in the same place. I was preferred officer of the day, and I had delight in throwing them out of the little enlisted club we had in the compound. Was not on a real friendly basis with the RRO chief of staff, nor did with any of the people there accordingly. But they were there, we were there, they were doing their job, and we were doing our job. We were there when the Civil War started between the Greeks and the Turks. By that time, I had moved up, and I was the RPS custodian. I had in charge for the commanding officer the registered publications and equipment for the operation. It was like a very highly organized bookkeeping system where you maintain the manuals to fix them, operate them, and anything connected with them. And it was all done by numbers, and you were accountable for burning and destruction of any changes or modifications thereto, and it was a very sophisticated system. I spent a good bit of time keeping mine in order. It was a lot of work involved. I didn't get weary of the work. A bad way to put it. I didn't get weary because of the work, and therefore I didn't get weary in the work. But it kept me on my toes. There was no room for error, and it was a constant continuing job. I was a comm chief and the RPS custodian, and we went on from there. I was one of the last ones to get transferred off the island. Due to the fact it is when I got the last of my equipment and operations and maintenance manuals moved and shipped out by courier. The only thing that was left is what the RRO or the CIA people graciously accepted responsibility for what they were going to take and use. This is one time where I was quite pleased with the CIA. They could have left it all there, and I would have had to dispose of it. They made my job in getting out a lot easier. We left there in middle of 1974, and orders were rather difficult to get, and nobody knew exactly what or where or when. We were talking via the teletype to Washington, and we were on the phone to Washington. The best I could come up with, as I said, I prefer not to cross the Mississippi and go west, and I prefer to stay out of Washington, D.C., so anything else is acceptable with the exception of your offer. I can extend 2 years and go to Guam. I left it at that. Finally, my orders came through, and I got must have been dealing with a detailer who got out the map layout of Washington, D.C. with a rather expendable compass and pinpointed the city's middle. I would say DuPont Circle is probably fairly close. Off of DuPont Circle, there ran a street called Nebraska Avenue. My next duty station was 3801 Nebraska Avenue, Northwest, the Naval Security Headquarters, to which I reported very unhappily. I don't know what I expected, but I wasn't really expecting to go back to Washington, D.C. I should have been actually sent back overseas somewhere because of my tour in Pensacola. I wasn't out long enough to consider it a tour. But anyway, that was my thinking, and the Navy had something in mind for me, which I didn't know what. I reported in, and by that time, my executive officer, or deputy director of the Naval Security Group Detachment, CQS Nav, Captain Patrick March, was now Admiral March, and he was the director of the Naval Security Group activity. I met with the Admiral shortly after my arrival, and we reminisced a little bit, and he asked me what I had in mind. And I said, unfortunately, I'm probably going to retire. And he thought this was highly unusual, being and I was at the peak of my career, as he put it. As the case may well be, maybe I was at the peak of my career. But however, through the grapevine, I had rumors. I don't know if he was aware of them or not. I didn't really bring up the subject, but I think it was Z-gram number 69 was due to hit the press. The essence of Z-gram 69 was the Navy was not pursuing the idea of how long you've been in a place. If you had your 20 years in day for day, you could put in for retirement and move on to a new career. I weighed this Z-gram over in my mind for quite a while, even before it came out in print. And I decided the best thing for me to do was pull a MacArthur and figure old chiefs never die, they just fade away. So I was ready to fade away. And this is what I did. I retired in September, October of 1974 and returned to the mountain from whence I came.
Wow, that's a great career, Harry. And you went back to Pennsylvania after that?
Yes, I did. Went back to Somerset.
Aha. Tell us just, I know you've mentioned with fondness Admiral McCain and no doubt Admiral March and of course, Commander Gordon. Were there any others in your Navy career that stood out for you, people that you've really had high regard for that you remember with fondness?
Oh, sure. The Director of Naval Security, or of Naval Security Group Detachment, CQS Nav, John F. Skinner, Captain, United States Navy, was a what you would call the grand old sailor of the line, and very sophisticated and very knowledgeable in his job occupation. As we mentioned, Captain March was his deputy. We went on to the Oxford, where I had an experience to serve under Commander Thomas Avery Cosgrove. There was an old salt of old salts. He started out in the Navy just as I did. He went to boot camp, and he worked his way up in the Navy from seaman apprentice to commander of a U.S. naval ship at sea. He later became Comservalent, which he had command over all the ships of service Atlantic. He was a spicy ship-going sailor who used to get some rather interesting messages from supply, like your ship has used more paint than any ship in Comservland, things of this nature. He was the only one that I ever saw turn completely beet red when he found out he was on a ship that was 20 miles out of Kansas City or someplace in the Midwest, because a navigator sent out a navigation report and figures didn't come out right. I happened to be in Andy's office when he not only ushered me out the door, he practically threw me out the door in hunt of this navigator and personally deliver him back to his office. I was a first-class petty officer at the time. We knew the annex of Captain Cosgrove, and we had been through many shellback initiations, and we know what we had to do to clean up the ship. We knew exactly what we were expected to do on work parties. We knew exactly what to polish, what to paint. And he was an easy book to read, but we left him as a sailor he was. He's probably one of the most interesting characters I can think of just by his history.
That's great. Harry, we're ending, nearing the end of our allotted time from the recording capability that we have, and you've had a marvelous, marvelous career, and you're a wonderful storyteller. It's just terrific to follow you through your career. It's been a treat. Share with us, if you will, how you and Yvonne wound up in Fernandina Beach. Please.
As I said, after I retired from the Navy, we went back to Pennsylvania and Somerset, and our son, who was born in London, according to British law, the British citizen in our family, was in the second or third grade, and Yvonne had a terrible time with the winters, so her boss, who she was working for, was opening an office in Sarasota. So I sold out the business that I was in at the time, which was an antique and restoration business, and we moved to Florida. Richard was out of high school at this time, and he was going to college in Florida Institute of Technology, which he graduated as an ocean engineer. He got married, and they moved to Amelia Island because he was employed by Jefferson Smurfit, the paper company. And when our grandchildren were born, it was like a monthly ritual to make the trip from Sarasota to Amelia Island in Nassau County. One day when I was going back to Sarasota, my wife asked me, "Why don't we move to Amelia Island?" To wit, I almost wrecked a car on 75 and saw the handwriting on, this time on the windshield, that all the above is not going to be the right answer. So I probably thought about it for about 5 miles, and then I said to her, "When we get back to Sarasota, you go into work and tell him, your boss, that you're going to return to Amelia Island and find his residence." This is, of course, not, and he has nothing to do with me, I was working for Rhodes Furniture and quite happy. This was her thing, and I expect her to be the chief in charge and take care of it in her way, to which she did. And in 1998, we arrived on Amelia Island and Nassau County and joined the Prince of Peace Lutheran Church, and we've been here ever since.
Boy, that's great. We are honored to have you as a neighbor and a friend and a veteran and a shipmate. And thank you for your sharing your recollections with us for the benefit of our nation. Harry, and thank you for a wonderful career. This concludes the interview with Harry E. Baumann,